Okay, thanks for bearing with us, folks. A few little technical glitches getting started here, but just a few reminders before we get started today. And Dr. Bash, you should see the start my webcam now.
Yes.
Okay. Folks, my name is Molly Marin. I am the New York State RTI Technical Assistance Center webinar coordinator. You see Dane Marco is the name on the chat. It's really me. We're in a transition period. This is my second last webinar with the TAC, and Dane will be taking over. So I just wanted you to know that is really me. It's not Dane. So just a few things. All upcoming professional development offerings are on our webpage at nysrti.org. A copy of the PowerPoint is available on our webpage. I posted the link in the chat to make it easy for you. During today's presentation, use the chat box for any questions or comments that you may have. And at the end of today's presentation, we'll post a link to an evaluation. I'll also send it via email. If you could take a few minutes to complete that, we appreciate the feedback. We're very pleased to have back with us Dr. George Bash to present our fourth webinar in our Strand 16, Response to Intervention, a Multi-Tiered System of Support series. Today's topic is aligning instruction and interventions with the CCLS and integrating instructional practices across the tiers. Dr. George Bash is a professor and director of the Institute for School Reform at the University of South Florida and director of the Florida Statewide Problem Solving RTI Project for the Florida Department of Education. And at this time, it's my pleasure to welcome back Dr. Bash.
Hey, hello, everybody. Welcome back, or welcome, whichever the case might be. This is the fourth webinar that we have done, and I'm going to give it a little review, and then we're going to get right into it. The goals of this whole webinar series have been to understanding the key components of MTSS, implementing them within the Common Core Learning Standards, how to integrate database problem solving into the process, how to align instruction and interventions, ensuring the integration of academic skills, behaviors, engaging students, meeting the needs of students with disabilities and students with 504 accommodations. Hopefully have some good conversations. Maybe by the end of the day, if you're not yet asleep, you can reflect, celebrate, reverberate, and breathe, and get fired up for this. So the goals for today are looking at the characteristics of tiers 1, 2, and 3, scheduling for multi-tiered systems of support, and intervention effectiveness. We're going to go in three sections here today. And at the end of each section, I'm going to put up some stuff for you to respond to see the degree to which you are either agreeing with what we're talking about or currently implementing. But before we get started, I would like to know who you are here today. I see a few of the names that I'm familiar with, but Molly's going to post a little poll, and if you can say who you are, that would be awesome. So Molly, can you put that getting acquainted poll up here?
Oh, I'm having trouble dragging it. I don't know if you could drag it.
Let me see. Nope. I don't have control, I don't think, of the... let me see.
Sorry.
Hold on. No, I can't move it.
Okay. Oh, no, I can't get it off at all. I'm having technical problems today. I moved it a little.
Oh, we're going to go ahead and get started.
Yeah.
So, Molly, when you can get it, we'll just drop it in as soon as you can get it.
Okay.
Okay?
I can't even get it off the screen.
Well, let's see here. There's some things popping up here. Michelle Brantner is here with she's a superintendent with a group of building and district level administrators with me. Welcome. Deborah is a reading specialist at Alexander Central School in New York State. Awesome. It looks like there's a group of people here. So in any event, we'll go ahead and see if we can get that poll over. But I want to go ahead and get started because I know that
okay,
you're well after work. Okay, awesome.
There we go. Sorry about that, folks.
So if you'll just complete that poll, that'd be great. Good. Well, we know that there are a number of people in different settings, so it's a nice distribution of participants today. Okay, let's go ahead and get started. So I've been working in education a long time, about 43, 44 years. I've been a building principal, a district administrator, school psychologist, whole variety of positions. In addition to now directing all of this stuff here in Florida. So a quote that Maya Angelou had about that I think is just perfect for educators is do the best you can until you know better, and then when you know better, do better. So nothing that we're talking about here would in any way reflect on practices that have occurred in the past and have been wrong or something like that. We're just striving to do better. The critical components of MTSS that we've talked about from the get-go, there are six of them. All six of these individually are evidence-based that when you use the practices under each of these areas, they're evidence-based for improving student outcomes. Some of you are familiar with the SAM, which is our self-assessment of multi-tiered systems of support. It's a progress monitoring tool for implementation. And it is organized around these six areas. Today, what we're really going to be focusing on is multiple tiers of instruction and intervention and data evaluation. We're focused on some of the other ones in the other webinars, but clearly also capacity building is part of this. But these six elements comprise the critical components of MTSS. So let's take a look at Tier 1, and just a reminder, is that Tier 1 core instruction is defined as what everyone gets. It's not what they get, it's who gets it. What we do know is that a multi-tiered system of supports is built on this foundation or core. So if it is a highly effective core, then it tends to occur that Tier 2 and Tier 3 will be more effective. If it is an ineffective core, here's the problem, is that in an ineffective core where people are referred to tiers two and tier three, if it's ineffective, then a lot of kids get referred for tier two and tier three. The problem is that we don't have the staff to follow the kids. So I've said multiple times before that 80% of students should be able to be educated in Tier 1 and be successful. Now, there's a number of reasons for that, but one of which is basically 80% of all the resources in the school district are allocated to Tier 1. That includes personnel, bus seats, square footage, air conditioning, maintenance staff, building staff, lighting. 80% goes to Tier 1, including percent of staff. So if you're in a place where you have, and hopefully you're not, but if you are, where you have 50% of your kids are proficient, that means that 20% of your staff, 100% minus the 80% in core, 20% of your staff are expected to fix 50% of the kids. And that's not possible. So in MTSS, when we implement this over a 3 to 5 year period, we put most of that first year, year and a half, just on what does core look like. So we're going to spend some time with that this afternoon. The most legitimate and effective school improvement effort is not designing a system of interventions to help students at risk, but rather upgrade the core curriculum. And Mike Matos has written a couple of books on RTI. One of them is called About Time, And it's basically how to use time and schedules within a multi-tiered system. So the vision of Tier 1, what is our vision? Number one, it has to be aligned with standards. If it's not, then you have the obvious issue that when you administer state assessments that are supposedly aligned with standards, your students are not going to do well because the instruction they've been getting has not been aligned with what is being assessed. The second part of it is it has to be engaging. As we all know, there are two parts to the teaching-learning process. One is using high-quality, evidence-based instructional strategies. But if those strategies, they could be high-quality, they could be evidence-based, but if they are not engaging your students, then that instruction and effort, in essence, is falling on deaf ears. Because of the diversity that we have in our school districts and the fact that it feels like general education teachers are supposed to be teachers, counselors, nurses, therapists, religious leaders, you name it. Because we have kids with such needs in our school districts right now, we need to embed universal design for learning principles into Tier 1. And we're going to talk about how to do that. And the last bullet, as we think about Tier 1, is it has to consider academic and behavior factors. It's a little bit related to engagement, but we'll talk a little bit more about that as we move along. So the first issue is that it needs to be standards-based instruction. I think we all know what the standards are. We know how they progress. They're clearly defined for each grade level. They serve as the content for the high-stakes assessment. They utilize benchmark assessments to determine if students are on track or not. We need to be able to use Tier 1 data to determine who is on or off track for meeting the standards at the end of the year, and we need to do that no later than the first grading period. It looks like, for whatever reason here, the connection was lost. So I'm just going to keep talking for a second. I don't know whose end this was on here. Hold on, just stand by for one moment. It's trying here.
I'm working on the back end too. Whoops. I'm working on the back end trying to get it back. Hopefully okay. Those of you who are on are not having trouble today. And if it's coming back for you, Dr. Bash, I would keep going.
Let me also just go see here very quickly. I just relaunched it from this end. I have connectivity on everything else. I don't know what happened with this. Hold on a second.
Okay.
It should pop up here.
Yeah, I'm relaunching too, so... And hopefully we haven't lost anybody. Bear with us, folks.
Okay, here we go.
Great.
Sorry, are you logging me in or getting me in there, Molly?
No, I'm just trying to get myself back in.
Okay.
Are you not using that in?
No, it says a request to enter has been sent to the host.
Oh, no. Okay. The tech person shouldn't say that. Stay with us. if you have the PowerPoint slides, you can talk to those. Everybody else should hopefully went and downloaded them. And I will keep working on the back end here.
Okay. Let me get my slides, and I'll just start using those. Okay. Okay, so I'm on some fundamental principles of standards-based instruction. And we just said that we're utilizing benchmark assessment to determine if students and the curriculum is on track. We'll take a look at that in a moment. So I'm going to the next slide now, which is Common Core standards. And one of the things that I want to point out, it says, how is the demand of this standard rising across the grades? And it starts with kindergarten. One of the factors that's really important in core instruction is to ensure that all teachers K-12 understand this happens to be a comprehension standard, reading standards for literature, that understand what their role is for that year in the standards. So one of the things that is important here and that is very important to us is that kindergarten teachers understand that their job, one of their main jobs, is to ensure that students can pull key details out of text. Well, it looks like we're back here. Key details out of text. That key details term runs all the way to the 12th grade standards. So part of the thing about core instruction is ensuring that everybody understands where their role is and that they have to deliver kids to the next year who are ready to start that year. So the slide that I have up here, Molly, I don't have a presenter. I can't seem to move this slide. Are you with me? Can you hear me, Molly? Okay, there we go. That last thing, assist in the identification of essential elements of instruction. So a very effective strategy that we've used over the years for kids who are struggling or are behind in January or February is that the teacher who has those students meets with the teacher from the next grade level and says, this student is behind. I've got 4 months left. What are the absolute critical non-negotiable things that you want students to come to you with so that teachers in the current grade level can begin to strategically instruct toward the expectations for the beginning of the next year? So back to this slide now. So for example, and I want to make a point out of this, it's important. The kindergarten standard for reading standards for literature says, with prompting and support, retell familiar stories, including key details. And then you will see that key detail or central message that keeps appearing and reappearing through the standards. So if we take a look at the kindergarten, for instance, the terms here are very different. With prompting and support, that means that teachers put context to the questions. They give clues. They give hints. But retell familiar stories. This is not raw comprehension. These kids have to be familiar with the story first, because the only thing that is really the target of the instruction here is being able to pull key details. Obviously not reading it. This is not a measure of how much you remember about something you've never heard of before. So it puts a lot of burden on kindergarten teachers to be sure that they're focusing instruction on key details and not semantics or a student's unfamiliarity with the story. This process of moving all the way through the standards is obviously spiraled and continues to build rigor. And that concept has to be understood, particularly when we're dealing with students who are behind. What is it in particular? What is the main thing that the teachers in the next grade want this kid to be able to demonstrate? So we spend a lot of time in unpacking these standards, understanding how a kindergarten teacher contributes to 12th grade expectations, and being sure that people are focused on what the standard expects, not their own idea of whatever the standard is measuring. So jumping ahead now, we said that instruction, big vision idea of instruction is that it has to be engaging. So in order to determine if instruction in Tier 1 is engaging, the first thing we have to do is to be able to conduct observations and identify what type of instructional strategies are being used. So this is an example, this is an actual high school example, in which observations were done in a series of classrooms that were focused on literature. And the breakdown of what percent of the time these high school teachers in, this is ninth grade literature, were using different instructional strategies is displayed here. So 24% of the time it was explicit instruction. Independent practice was another 27% of the time. So 41% of the time was explicit instruction and independent practice. 13% of the time the teacher modeled it. 13% of the time the teachers guided it with their support, and 6% of the time there was guided practice with peer support. So we understand what the breakdown is of the instructional strategies. Now let's look at how students responded to those instructional strategies. So what we see on this slide is that roughly 79 to almost 90% student engagement tied to three instructional strategies: modeling, guided with teacher support, and guided with peer support. But remember from that previous slide that the teachers were only using those high engagement strategies 32% of the time. 68% of the time, the teachers were using strategies for which the students had roughly 50% engagement. So there's no way that the students are going to acquire the skills that was the focus of instruction when their engagement is at 50%. So the point I'm trying to make here is the first thing we have to look at is what instructional strategies have high levels of student engagement. This is directly measurable. And when there's a high level of student engagement combined with highly effective instructional practices, you're going to get the most student growth and performance. However, when you have students engaged half the time, I don't care how good the instructional strategies are, the students are not going to progress. So one of the things we have to start doing is simultaneously measuring the instructional strategies being used and the level of student engagement with those strategies. The three principles of universal design are providing multiple means of representation. That means teachers using multiple ways of providing information. So if we had a sixth grade class where we have a group of kids reading at the second grade level because of fluency issues, then there would be no point in having all kids read passages in order to answer comprehension questions, because all those kids who have a fluency level at the second grade level are not going to be able to read it. So teachers would have some kids reading the passages. Other kids would be getting it perhaps through text-to-speech software or having it read on tape or having someone else read it to them. But we want to build that into tier one. We don't want to retrofit that once tier one isn't working for some kids because you've lost instructional time. The second principle is providing multiple methods for kids to demonstrate what they know. So some of those kids might write stuff out. Some of the kids might have to answer it verbally. Some of the kids might use speech to text. There's a variety of ways. When, for example, in literacy, the focus is on comprehension, we don't want basic skills that students don't have, fluency, for example, to interfere with trying to measure a skill or a standard that the fluency is a barrier to. When if we read the stuff to those kids, they would be able to comprehend it. And those two principles, when they're active, really result in providing students with multiple means of engagement. So I know I'm beating the horse here on the engagement issue, but I would just ask the principals in the group is how often do we observe teachers teaching and looking at the strategies they use and what have you, but we don't simultaneously measure student engagement. So it looks good, and I call these Motel 6 strategies or Motel 6 kids, lights on, it looks good, but unfortunately nobody's home. So some of the characteristics of Tier 1, we have to deliver them in a sufficient amount. It has to be differentiated. It has to be delivered in the context of a positive learning environment. It has to be diverse, teacher-led, student-led, and it has to be as effective for diverse students, including those with disabilities. We'll talk about each of those areas. So the first issue here is relating to engagement is positive learning climates. So we don't have a lot of time today, obviously, to talk about all of these issues in detail, but I want to throw these out for you to consider. That positive learning environment goes a long way towards student engagement. So how do we create a culture of respect, positive interactions? A person who has done a tremendous amount of research in the area of school-wide behavior and positive behavior supports, George Sugai, who's at the University of Connecticut, he and I are working together to work with teachers in Tier 1 to look at some of these characteristics in a very concrete way. So high rates of positive interactions, what does that mean? Minimally, it means particularly for students who are struggling, that the positive teacher-student interaction needs to be somewhere between 3 and 5 positives for every corrective or negative. If it gets below 3, those interactions themselves contribute to disengagement. So how do we measure that? We measure it through direct observation or teachers keeping track of those interactions themselves. If we don't keep track, then often with a group of students, those interactions get close to 1-to-1 or a negative ratio, and then we see students disengaging. I don't know what's going on here, Molly, but we've lost the connection again. So I'm just going to go to my PowerPoint that I have. It looks like it's coming back. It's back.
Okay.
This is bizarre.
Toggle the. I don't know what's going on, but I can always toggle the PowerPoint for you too.
Yeah. Go ahead and toggle the PowerPoint for right now. Here we go. I think I got it. Okay. I got it. Back.
Okay.
So the issue here is participatory. How is that defined? Is it simply answering questions, or is it student-led? Students are asked for ways in which this lesson could be presented. Structured, clearly defined practices. Students have to be able to predict what's going to happen next. So I'm not going to do deep dives into each of these, but culture of respect, including rates of positive interactions. So a culture of respect would be defined as one of the indicators is when teacher-student interactions are 3-to-1 or greater, positive to negative. Participatory would be using that universal design for learning principle 2 is what are different ways that students can participate. So that if some students are not as adept in one form of participation, they have multiple ways that they can choose to engage the lesson. Hit the wrong way here. Social emotional learning, explicit instruction and pedagogy that promotes this. So let me give one example. A good friend of mine that I get to work with is Anita Archer. Many of you may know her. Her work in the area of explicit instruction is highly respected throughout the United States and the world. She has a video she shares in which she demonstrates in a middle school classroom that students do not know how to participate in the lesson. They don't have the participatory skills, or they don't have the confidence, the self-awareness, the self-management to do it. So she spends 8 minutes and 20 seconds at the beginning of the lesson teaching the entire class and giving them feedback on how to participate in this lesson, how to make a decision about when to respond, how to respond. And once she does that, then that environment is safe for students. Everybody has been taught how to interact, and the level of student participation increases dramatically. The restorative approaches are really important. One of the things we know and we have shown in the other webinars is the negative impact of exclusionary practices like office discipline referrals, in-school suspension, out-of-school suspension, on student academic proficiency. So I have used as an example before on this webinar that in a district that I work with that has 100 schools, we looked at the difference between attendance, chronic non-attendance on proficiency in the area of English language arts and literature. We did it elementary, middle, and high school. Compared to exclusionary discipline practices. And what we found is that for exclusionary disciplinary practices, that those kids who got referred to the office chronically, and at the elementary, that means 3 times a semester, middle school 6 times, and high school 4 times. For those students, the proficiency rates were about 26% less than for students who had attendance issues. However, when we have restorative practices that basically are tied to positive environment, teaching kids skills, giving them opportunities to make up what they missed. So we're trying to restore the effect of those exclusionary practices, then students' academic proficiency increases dramatically. So just some food for thought on social emotional learning. This is a rubric that defines the 10 most effective characteristics of instruction for literature, for English language arts. And you can read them here. It's clear goals and objectives, explicit, systematic, etc. The point that I want to make is that these strategies or instructional characteristics have differential impact on students. For example, for English language learners, explicit guided practice with corrective feedback are highly effective instructional strategies, more so than any of the other ones on this page for English language learners. So the question is when we differentiate instruction, do we know ahead of time which instructional strategies are evidence-based for a particular group of kids, like students with learning disabilities or English language learners or what have you? And these strategies, we don't want to just differentiate instruction. We want to differentiate it in the way that we align the characteristics with the type of student for whom that characteristic has been evidence-based. One example of instruction in Tier 1 that is highly effective for all students, let's just call them general ed students, but is also highly effective for students with learning disabilities is collaborative strategic reading. This is research done on middle school kids. And one of the things that that is important to note here, let me turn my video back on. One of the things that is important to note here is as we look at these lines, we see that this is highly effective, the top line, for students without learning disabilities. But when we look at the dotted black line compared to the dashed gray line, we see that this CSR strategy when delivered in general education results in growth rates for students with disabilities that is significantly greater than the typical kind of instruction provided for students with learning disabilities in the area of comprehension, often by special ed teachers in a pull-out kind of fashion. So my point here is, as we're building instruction in Tier 1, and we know we have English language learners in our classroom, we have students with learning disabilities in our classroom, there are instructional approaches that, when delivered in Tier 1, will benefit not just all of the kids in Tier 1 that don't have other challenges or barriers, but in this case, they also simultaneously benefit students with learning disabilities, which then makes the specially designed instruction that special ed teachers provide even more powerful. However, if instruction in Tier 1 is selected without that in mind, then what we have is that English language learners, students with disabilities, that becomes dead time for them. And then we have special ed teachers or ESOL teachers trying to do a heavy lift and teach these kids and do all of the work with those kids, when we could have selected instructional strategies or programs in Tier 1 that simultaneously benefited multiple groups of kids. So as building principals, you know, is the expectation for your PLCs, your professional learning communities or groups, is your expectation that when Tier 1 instruction is developed, that we think about all of these kids and select instructional strategies that will positively impact multiple groups at one time? This is another example, promoting adolescent comprehension through text, PACT. In this research, in the area of content acquisition, English language learners and non-English learners with disabilities were able to significantly benefit from PACT instruction provided in general education classes. So in this case, if you chose to use PACT as a way to develop comprehension, both your English learners and your non-English learners with disabilities would have huge benefit just from instruction delivered in the general ed classroom. So I think the major point moving away from here is we have to begin to select our instructional approaches that will have a powerful impact on different groups in that general ed class, and not just think about those kids that typically will respond to a wide range of instruction. We want to look at evaluating the effectiveness of Tier 1 instruction in a number of ways. I've embedded the effectiveness stuff in here along the way with each of the tiers. And at the end, I'm going to give you some summative kind of effectiveness ratings. In this example, you see that this is third grade for an entire district with fall, winter, and spring benchmarking data. You can just look at this and tell that the instruction is becoming less and less effective as the year goes on. We start the year with 50 some odd percent of the kids who are proficient, and we end the year with barely more than 40%. So whatever's going on in this district, it's not effective because fewer and fewer kids are proficient as the year goes on. That's one way of measuring effectiveness. At a classroom level, this is a reading assessment. This happens to be kindergarten. That is rated by colors. Green is basically proficient. Yellow is moderate risk, and red is high risk. You clearly see, looking from left to right, that we move from a whole lot of yellow and red in the picture to very little of it. So across the year, more and more students got better. And in fact, with the exception of one student, the red on the far column, that was a student that had no level, that they came into the district in the middle of the year. So we started at some point during the year. We had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10 of these kids, basically more than half of the class, was at risk at some level. And we ended the year with 1. That's highly effective instruction. So I think, Molly, if let's see, what slide number are we on here? Did I ask you to drop in? No, I don't think I did yet. We're going to keep going. So for tier two is what some kids get. And I'll just reiterate for those of you who are new to the presentation that in tier two, we don't problem solve kids. We problem solve problems and we group kids together who have the same instructional need. So for example, we would group kids together who had a need for fluency. We would group kids together who had a need for vocabulary. We would group kids together who had a need for fundamental math principles. And we would select highly effective strategies to teach those kids as a group. This is called standard protocol. That typically results in about 70% of the kids moving toward proficiency. We've talked in earlier sessions that improvement is effective, rather, is a combination of two different data sets. One is the kids who are proficient, plus all of the kids who are lowering their level of risk. So going from red to yellow, yellow to green. So anybody who's closing the gap, even though if they're not there yet, or is proficient, are counted in the bucket of kids that we would say are indicators of effective instruction. So our effective instruction criterion for tier two is 70% of the kids are either proficient or are lowering their level of risk toward proficiency. So for the district level administrators and principals on this call, I would ask you this question. Do you have a school consensus or a district-wide guideline for what is defined as effective tier two? For us, that's 70% of kids either proficient or moving toward proficiency through lowering risk. Now, one of the things I want to drop in here very quickly is, and we seem to have lost it again, Molly, is that in a multi-tiered system, tier two and tier three are not just interventions. For some kids, they're interventions, and the kids improve, and they're able to become independent, independent learners, and the interventions can be faded. But that's not true of all kids. Some kids are going to continue to need tier two and tier three to maintain proficiency, basically for their entire educational career. So when I say that 70% is the effectiveness indicator for tier two, and some kids are, and that's proficiency plus moving toward proficiency, I have some people ask, well, if they're proficient, why are they getting tier two? And the reason is because if they weren't getting tier two, they wouldn't be proficient. So you can try to fade that instruction, but if the student can't handle it, then you're going to have to continue to provide that in order to get that level of proficiency. So let's talk briefly about tier two. Tier two is the first step where we intensify instruction. And I'm going to say this again to district folks on the call as well as building principals. Do you have a district-wide definition of how to intensify instruction? If we don't, then intensification in one building may be very different from another building. So we have three indicators of intensified instruction. One is more time, more practice, more rehearsal, more exposure to high quality instruction. Typically, tier two is up to 50% more time than tier one. So for 90 minutes of ELA in an elementary school, that could be up to 135 more minutes, up to a total of 135 minutes with 45 minutes more for tier two. And by the way, tier two can be in the general ed classroom or push in, pull out. The second area is we have to narrow the focus of the instruction to the skills that the kids in that group are struggling with. So where we have the five big areas of reading in Tier 1, we're going to focus that to fewer than five and sometimes one or two in Tier 2. And then the type of instruction. The more students are struggling, the more instruction has to be explicit. It has to have powerful instructional routines. It has to be guided, and students have to get frequent feedback. One of the most powerful instructional strategies for kids who are struggling but not severely is pre-teach, review, and reteach. So as we said in the previous webinars, academic engaged time, the amount of time that kids are exposed to high-quality instruction is the best predictor of a student's rate of growth. So time becomes critical here. We can never supplant Tier 1 and expect to get any results that we're happy with. We have a formula that we use to, it's just our formula. Frequency is, you know, how often and how long, that's getting at the time issue. The focus is getting at the focus issue that we talked about. The format of the instruction, the how, that would be getting at the type. And then we look at three other things. The size of the instructional group depends upon how similar the kids are at their instructional level and how far behind those kids are. What data are we going to use to measure progress, and what professional development coaching support do we have to provide for the implementers? That's really critical. If there's one area that I could focus on today for Tier 2, it is don't have your, whatever you, whether they're child study teams or teacher support teams or problem-solving teams, whatever you call them, don't have them just give teachers suggestions of what to do and then expect them to go out and do that without levels of support. It's not going to work. I already talked about these. It's a standard protocol approach. Focusing on those essential skills we talked about earlier, what are the skills that are going to be most important to start the next year with? And focus on those. Once we get to Tier 2, we also have to ensure that at least for, I'm going to just say 50% of the time, we have to be sure that the instructional materials that are used are instructional materials used in Tier 1. Students who struggle cannot make this transition from materials in some kind of program off the shelf and how to apply that to the work that they are using in core instruction. So let's say that we're using Wilson's Foundation to promote fluency and vocabulary. That's great. But half of this time that we're spending with the students, they have to apply those strategies that they learn with Wilson's to actual materials from Tier 1. There's a number of reasons for that. One of the reasons is to ensure that they're getting the content of those Tier 1 instructional materials, which are aligned with standards, so that when high-stakes assessments come around, that the students who are getting Tier 2 and Tier 3 actually have been getting Tier 2 and Tier 3 in the same content as Tier 1. That's going to be essential because that's the content that is going to be measured. I can assure you that your New York Common Core learning standards did not focus on the content that occurred in Wilson's Foundations to align their state assessments with. Developing a schedule for Tier 1 to accommodate Tier 2. The first question we have to ask is, how many students need how many extra minutes of time? What will occur during those minutes? who's going to deliver it, when can they deliver it, where is it going to be delivered. So I want to show you an elementary schedule, and then I'm going to give you an example of a high school schedule. This elementary schedule is for fourth grade in a particular elementary school. And there are, unlike some of you, there this is a school that has four teachers at each grade, or at least four teachers at the fourth grade. And the schedule in this school is blocked, meaning that art, music, library, guidance, that type of stuff, is all the kids at a grade level go to those special instructional classes at the same time. And that way the fourth grade team has meeting time to work on instructional alignment, that type of thing. But if you'll take a look at the left-hand column, the other thing I want you to look at is that the schedule is not the same every day of the week. So we flex up schedules by doing different things on different days. Fourth grade happens to be Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday is one schedule with a modified version on Wednesday. But you will look at the left-hand side. So the principals on the call, I want you to think about this. There are 11 transitions during the day. If you count the number of rows, there are 11 of them. In elementary schools, on a good day with light southerly breeze and low humidity, you can get kids from completely engaged in one subject area to equally engaged in the next subject area in about 8 minutes' time. I don't mean that they've got the book on their desk and they've put the other books away, and they're engaged in the instruction is about 8 minutes. If you multiply 11 by 8, that's 88, let's round it to 90, 90 minutes out of 350, about 25% of the time, is students transitioning. We cannot afford to give up 25% of our academic engaged time every day, in particular, if we have large numbers of students who are struggling. So back to MTSS. If you look at 8:45, you'll see there's 90 minutes of reading from 8:45 to 10:15. There is 30 minutes of reading intervention from 12:30 to 1 o'clock. And then there is 60 minutes of language arts, ESOL, or other things from 2 to 3. If you add up those minutes, you come up with 180 minutes, potentially, for English language arts. Now, what you'll see is missing is social studies. And we push social studies into language arts, because in this school, there are so many kids struggling with reading that we need that time. So if we go back to that time thing I said about before, 90 minutes for English language arts in tier one. Tier two is up to 45 minutes more. Tier three is up to 45 minutes more. That's a total of 180. Unless it's built into the schedule, you can't give kids that much time. So a MTSS schedule, at the very least, looks at having up to 180 available minutes for English language arts. Now, for kids who don't need it, teachers can use that last 60 minutes for other types of things, or we can group kids and differentiate them, etc. But this schedule enables you to implement an MTSS for reading for any kid in the elementary school. Let me give you an example of a high school that we just finished working with, or we're still working with it. Up in your neck of the woods, actually. It's up in Massachusetts. In this high school, every algebra teacher, ninth grade algebra, taught one period of advanced, two periods of regular, and one period of kids who needed extra help, and they were low-performing kids. The goal of the high school was to increase the amount of instruction for low-performing kids by 45, 50 minutes or beyond. So the high school principal and I sat down looking at the concept of pre-teach, review, and reteach, and his schedule, and the schedule of his teachers. And he was able through all of those teachers and the schedule to arrange for the low performing, the low group of kids to get two more periods a week, not a day, a week. So each of the periods is 50 minutes at this high school. So if your typical algebra, freshman algebra, that's 50 times five, you get 250 minutes a week of algebra. The kids in the low performing group, they got an additional two periods or another 100 minutes. So they went from 250 to 350. That's almost 50% more. Not quite, but almost. As a result of that schedule change, in June of this year, not only did the low-performing kids continue to outperform the regular kids by 8%, but 88% of them got a C or higher. No one failed. So every one of those kids in the low-performing group earned their credit, and 88% got C or higher. There was no more teachers, no specialized instruction. It was simply more instruction for kids taught by the same teachers. That is a classic example of how providing more time for kids who don't have disabilities. They may have come in without background knowledge. They may be inefficient listeners and studiers. They may not have been able to do homework at home, so they got to practice more in these extra two periods. The point is that there was no more expense to the school district, but you got all of these kids passing algebra. So that's a classic tier two. How do we measure it? We could measure it by D's and F's, A, B, C, D's and F's. With the elementary level, we could measure it by performance on benchmarking assessments. So if you look at this, and I want you to pay attention, you see the horizontal black line. I want you to look at the white space between the black line and the columns of red, yellow, and blue. Just look at that for a second. And now look at this slide. Back to this one. The white space represents distance from the benchmark. And now look at this one. So just by visualizing this, looking at it, you can see that a lot of that white space went away. And so did the connection. Perfect timing. If you go to the next slide, and I'm going to jump on I'm keeping a back slide here. If you go to the next slide, you will see a table. And that table is the actual percent of kids in each of those categories on these charts. So at or above proficiency in the fall was 63% of the kids. In the winter, it was 73%. So in 3.5 months, 10% increase in proficiency. For the on-watch kids, 3% more increased. But that's good, because with those kids, the reason it increased was because intervention and urgent intervention decreased. So you see in the fall, there were 27% of the kids red and yellow. In the winter, that number dropped to only 14%. So 50%, roughly 13 out of 27, 13% of the kids moved to on watch and above proficiency. That's how we measure the effectiveness of tier two. Tier three is highly intensive and individualized. Very few kids get this, because we don't have the personnel to deliver that type of instruction to large groups of kids. So this is the most powerful, the most impactful, the most intense that we can give in a building. It's more instructional time. In the case of reading, up to 45 minutes more time. It's smaller groups. We never do tier three individually. We will do that with groups of three, maybe four. A small group is much more effective than one-to-one instruction in most cases. more precisely targeted at the right level. That's the focus. More clear and more detailed explanations, that's the modeling and the guided. More systematic instructional sequences, they are, the student can predict them so that the scaffolding is heavy and the student can predict what's going to come next. More extensive opportunities for guided practice. This is, practice is important for this group. Guided, what that means is you scaffold it so that kids do not give the wrong answer, whether it's academic or behavior. And you, these kids that need intensive instruction, 95% of the time, they're not going to be able to answer answer correctly. So we scaffold for success and then gradually release that scaffolding. Lots of opportunity for error correction and feedback, and we have a general rule that a student has to be able to demonstrate at whatever level of scaffolding 5 correct responses in a row before we either start to reduce the scaffolding or move on to the next step of the instructional sequence. So resources and skills. Basically, this slide summarizes what I just said. One point I do want to make, and that is that once we have identified Tier 3 instruction that works, we want our general education teachers to know what those instructional sequences and routines are. Not because we're expecting general ed teachers to provide kids with a ton of Tier 3 instruction, but general ed teachers always work with kids individually to help them along, even if it's just drive-bys. They may only do it 3 or 4 or 5 times in a lesson. But when they do work with a kid individually, what we want them to do is to use these instructional routines that intensive instruction has identified as effective, even if they are not able to give any more individual time than previously. We want the individual time to use these effective instructional sequences. Once again, it's not going to take any more general ed teacher time, but they will use impactful instructional sequences. So whoever's providing the Tier 3 instruction and that general ed teacher have to work together. Imagine if a kid got, let's say, 3 to 5 of these Tier 3 instructional sequences a day in general ed. By the end of the week, that would be up to 25 more instructional opportunities that utilize the same instruction as the person providing Tier 3. And that way, they would not be competing with each other, if you will. Specially designed instruction, I'm just going to mention it here. That is instruction that is designed to reduce or eliminate the impact of a disability on a student's progress. Any specially designed strategies that special ed teachers are using with students, once again, those general ed teachers should know what those instructional routines are so that when they do get to work with these kids individually or in a very small group, they can use the same strategies that a special ed teacher is using and have more consistency across the settings. What I just said is on that slide. How do we measure that intensive? We've been through this before in the seminar, but we measure it with whether or not it's a positive response to instruction, closing the gap. This is a good example of it. Whether or not it is improved, but the gap is not closing, or whether, and that's a good example, or whether or not it has the rate of performance hasn't improved and the gap is widening. So we want a positive response to instruction. This would be an example of poor response. The one other thing I wanted to show here is how at a building level we can look at our instruction, particularly if we have diverse learners. I have two examples. One is diverse learners, and one is just tier 1, 2, and 3. This is middle school data. Look on the left side, we have three racial ethnic groups, white, black, and Hispanic, 430 white kids, 250 black kids, 210 Hispanic kids, 890 kids in the building. And of the white kids, 60 were referred for interventions. If you look at the far right column, that represents almost 14% of the white kids, 13.95. 48 black students were referred. That represents almost 20% of the black students in this building. 10 Hispanic kids, that represents less than 5%. So the first thing I want you to notice is that about 40% more black kids than white kids are referred for intervention. So if we just have 14 and 20%, we have 6% more black kids arithmetically, 6 out of 14 represents about 40% increase. So that tells us right away that core instruction is being less effective for black students than it is for white students. We have an overrepresentation of black students for help. So that would immediately tell us we have to look at our core instruction and see what we're doing with our black and African-American students. For those referred for intervention, of the 60 white kids, 15 were referred for evaluation, meaning the interventions didn't work. But it did work for 45 of the 60 because they're not being referred for evaluation. So they're either proficient with the extra help or moving toward proficiency. Intervention effectiveness, therefore, is 75%, 45 out of 60. Look at the intervention effectiveness for Black and African American students. It's 33%. For Hispanic students, it's 50%. We can never assume that interventions are equally effective across racial, ethnic, socioeconomic levels. So in this case, the core instruction was disproportionately less effective for Black students. But what's even worse is when they got to interventions, the intervention effectiveness was less than half for Black students what it is for white students. So building principles, all of our building principles monitor these kinds of data to ensure that our students, that our core instruction and our interventions are equally effective across groups. Here is how we take a look at effectiveness of tiers. So in this particular case, there are 480 kids in tier one. 450 of them are proficient. They're only getting tier one. So tier one percent proficient in tier one is 93%. That's highly effective. There are 110 kids getting tier two. 65 of them are proficient or lowering a level of risk. That's only 59% effectiveness. So that we have to take a look at tier two. Our goal, remember, was 70%. For tier three, we don't have a goal because it's the upper tier, but at least half of those kids should be either lowering their risk or are proficient. And so that is another way that we take a look at measuring instructional effectiveness. Because of our interruptions and stuff here today, we lost some time, and I went ahead and went through all of the slides before we dropped in those probes. But instead of dropping in the probes, what I would ask Molly to do is to email to you the sheet I sent to her with all of the probes on it, and you can do a self-evaluation using those probes. We have 3 to 5 minutes left. So if you have questions or comments, go ahead and use the chat box, and I will hang in here and see if I can answer any of those. So I see somebody typing right now.
And I will, as you requested, I will send that email later today or tomorrow morning for everybody.
Thank you, Molly. Waiting for some of these chats to pop up here.
Yeah, I see people typing. While people are typing, I'm going to post the survey. Emily, I'll take that question. The webinars are archived. They're on our webpage. The link I posted at the top of the chat would get you there. You can always email me, too. I'll put my email in, and I'd be happy to direct you to it.
Yes, Sheila. No, you're not missing anything. What we're looking at is 480 in Tier 1 that are getting only Tier 1. We separate out the tiers because those kids are not getting anything else. Let's say that that number was 480 and the number proficient was 400. There would be 80 students who that proficiency rating would be obviously a lot less. It would be something like, let's see, 10 twelfths. So that's about 80% or a little bit less. The reason we do that is because that figure, 93%, it's telling us that 7% of the students in Tier 1 are not proficient and they're not getting anything else. And those are 7% that are falling through the cracks. So though we go immediately to that 7% and say, what's going on? But you're absolutely right. You can combine those numbers however you want, but for the effectiveness of the tiers, we keep them for pure tiers, kids only getting Tier 1, kids getting Tier 1 and Tier 2, kids getting Tier 1, 2, and 3. No, it's a great question. Okay. I've lost the connection again, unfortunately.
Okay, I can read the last question in here if you
want. Okay, yep, please do.
In your ideal schedule, what are the students missing when they leave for Tier 2 or 3? And that's from Kathleen.
Hopefully, if the schedule is built to accommodate Tier 2 and Tier 3, they're not missing anything. So in the schedule you saw, we pulled in social studies into literacy. So, however, there are times, particularly when Tier 3 happens, that they have to miss stuff. So that is because those are fewer numbers of students. That is a discussion between the teachers and the parents and the kid. It's never math. We try for it not to be science, math, or literacy. If it has to be something else, then we rotate what that is. So for the first grading period, let's say it might be art, but it would not be art for the entire year. We would rotate what the kid is missing across areas where that would make sense. But to be honest with you, Kathleen, we often say to parents, do you want your kid to have the same schedule as everybody else? Or do you want your student to be able to read? And unfortunately, it comes down to that, and it becomes those are courageous conversations.
Okay, and you lost the connection. Kathleen's typing something, but I just want to apologize to everybody for the technical difficulties today. We'll be doing some testing and troubleshooting before our next webinar. I've been doing these for about 3.5 years, and this is we don't usually have these issues. So we hope you'll join us back on the 29th. Kathleen says, thank you, I like it. And I'd like to thank everybody for joining us and have a wonderful night.
Thank you again, everyone.